I didn't remember until just now. I herded my thumb.
You herded it?
I herded it.
What'd well, you do?
So we have all of our, like, extra storage outside in, like, those units. Like, the big metal that you put on, like,
what
ships.
What hurt your thumb? A heckin' unit.
Yeah, because they're really hard to open up. So my thumb got, like, squished Ooh. Underneath, like... Yeah, I was just sitting here like absentmindedly squeezing it going, ow, ow,
stop, ow, it. Stop squeezing it.
Ow.
Stop, Cassie, stop it.
Why does it hurt? Ow, why? And then I had to remind myself, oh, yeah, I hurt myself earlier today. I thought it was going to bruise, but
I hurt myself today by squeezing on my thumb. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Who Is My Doctor?
Who is my doctor?
Who is indeed? I'm your host, Zach. I know a lot about Doctor Who.
And I'm also your host, Cassie. And I don't know a lot about Doctor Who. We're taking it back to our roots, baby.
Getting that's a little classic introduction to the Wimdy Pod.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, baby. We're playing all the hits today, baby. More specifically, the hit we are playing is Series 7, Episode 11, The Crimson Horror.
The Crimson Horror?
No.
That's a rude title for a TV show.
No.
For family and friends.
No.
Crimson Whore.
No.
It's Crimson. How am I wrong?
The Crimson Horror.
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 Horror. Horror or what?
Horror or gentleman of the evening.
So they're a man.
Now, today we're watching Series 7, Episode 11. Series 7, Episode 11. The Crimson Horror, which is an episode that I have very strong inclinations that I think you will probably really enjoy this episode because I think it is your.
Oh, yeah.
I think it is your brand of cheese.
Now, what do you mean by that? For anybody not.
Well, this is.
Shush. Zip your lips.
Okay.
For anybody who doesn't know us on like a personal level. What about this episode makes you think I would like it based off of quote unquote my personal brand of cheese? What does that mean?
So there's a lot of aesthetic to the episode. It's set in Victorian London. So mm-hmm. we are returning to meet the Paternoster gang, but there's also a very like a more classic 80s feel to it in a way where like the villain's plan is kind of ridiculous. There's a lot of like obvious foreshadowing for twists. I find it hard to parse it, but I will say a lot of it is just the visual aesthetic of the show, being that it is a sci-fi show that in this episode is set in Victorian era London. I think we'll just have a very particular vibe for you.
Okay.
So I don't want to belabor it too much, but
well, I was really hoping you were going to say something along the lines of like, this is the first time Doctor Who does Pee-wee's Playhouse.
I mean,
oh my God, what?
I don't want to say you're right, but I don't want to say you're wrong either.
What? Okay. There's, what are my ding-dang questions so we can start watching?
Well, first of all, what do you think the Crimson Horror... What do you think will be in store in the Crimson Horror? Just from name alone.
I
mean,
I can tell you what the Crimson Horror is for most women in America at least once a month. Sorry, vagina/uterus havers. That's my personal Crimson Horror.
Well, let's get into the Cassie Perfassi just a little bit here. Today we have two multiple choice questions today, so I'm not taking it easy on you, but I am. I realize that you might need some focus. So I'm not spanning you off into the distance. Here's another point, actually, that might that will both be a thing that I think you will enjoy and also tie into the Cassie Perfassi. Cassie, do you know what an optogram is?
No.
Do you know the, I mean, this isn't true, but it was an idea that when you die, the last thing you see is imprinted into your eye.
Okay.
That's an optogram.
Okay.
So in this episode, the Paternoster gang is investigating a dead body, and said dead body has a surprise optogram of whom? Is it the doctor? Uh-huh. Is it Clara? Or is it Amy Pond?
Oh, well, that does not go with my answer of a Dalek.
The Crimson Horror is me. I am a little guy who is painted red.
I'm going to say Clara.
You say Clara.
So if we're going back to Victorian era London.
Mm-hmm.
That.
You think it's going to be a Clara Oswin Oswald shows back
up? I think so.
Okay.
I think that that's a little scary and topical, particularly because of, only because we're going back to that time frame. If we went back to modern day, then I would say Amy. But I am skirting around the doctor just because I think that that is more exciting to have it be a companion.
Okay, fair enough.
Not this guy over here.
Additionally, in this episode, people are being preserved.
Oh.
How do you think they're being preserved, Cassie? Is it in a fridge, in plastic wrap, or in a jar?
Oh, jar. Oh, I love jar.
You think we're getting some pickled people?
Jar!
I'm pickle Clara. It's fun. Can you imagine if this episode is what they took Pickle Rick from? they turn the doctor into a pickle. The funniest shit I've ever seen.
Clara, I've been turned into a pickle. I actually, if it's Matt Smith, it'd be
well, you see, funny thing happened. I seem to have turned myself into a pickle.
For our audiences at home, both of us just brought our hands in very close together as if we were raccoons cleaning a scrap of food, and then hands get really big and flappy, and that just kind of goes back and forth. That is how I think you do a successful Matt Smith as the doctor impression.
Well, let's find out together then, because I want to get to this episode. I want to get to this episode and see how you feel about it. So we're going to get to it.
Oh, yeah. What if I hate it?
I mean, I will be surprised if you hate it. I would be upset, but I wouldn't be like mortified if you didn't love it the way I expect you to. Anyway, so we will find out together if a dead guy's got Clara in his eye. And if people are being pickled, as we watch The Crimson Horror.
Are you feeling parched? A little anemic? Do you long for a taste that's both robust, refreshing, and definitely not blood?
Yes! I mean, Dr. Acula, am here to solve all of your thirst problems. Introducing Dr. Acula's Red Drink. It's a drink, and it's red. What more do you need to know? Delicious, and totally not blood. I cannot emphasize how much this is not blood. It is a special concoction from my personal, vineyard. Yes, I have a vineyard. Of course I do. Everyone has one. It is filled with grapes. Lots and lots of red, juicy grapes. This is a beverage for all of your beverage needs. Who doesn't love the taste of a good beverage? It's all natural and full of, electrolytes. And iron. It's fortified with iron. For your health. Yes, that's it. For your strength, to give you a healthy glow. No need to even go to store or place an order. I will come to you.
Hello? It is me, Dr. Acula, here to deliver your free sample. Could I just come inside for a moment? It is very bright and sunny out here. And I have a few more cases of red drink for you if you use my promo code. Yes, you may come into my house now at checkout. Just let me in. I'm a perfectly normal man with a perfectly normal non-blood red drink. The ad says it's for inside use only, so you must let me in. It's right there in the fine print. Just open the door, please. I'm getting very hungry. I mean thirsty. I mean, you're getting thirsty. I mean, Dracula, you beefed it again.
And we are back from the Crimson Aura.
Oh, no. It's Dip!
It's worse than Dip. It's the excrement of a red leech.
That looks not unlike our cat.
Like if our cat had an evil twin and was hairless.
If the horrible parts of our cat were isolated into one horrific little being.
If there was like an evil doppelganger to Rufus the Naked Mole Rat from Kim Possible.
Yeah.
So what'd you think, Cassie? How'd you like the episode?
I did like this one.
Okay, I had a feeling. This one was very goofy in a way that I'm like...
I wouldn't say goofy. The pacing was really... The pacing was pleasant, and it's... I mean, it's not unique to me by any means, but I really like, and it is a telltale sign for me when a story is succinct and very tight.
Yeah. Mark Gatiss, I think, is a very talented writer. He's a very talented lot of things.
He's the TV host for the Fantastic Four.
Yeah. So we brought him up last time we had an episode by him. He's very good at capturing, like, he's the closest we get to capturing the classic era feel of the show consistently.
Well, something else that I really appreciated is that this episode wasn't Dr. Light, because...
It's more diet doctor.
I mean, it was Light spelled L-I-T-E, just in the sense that we didn't see the doctor as himself for a good third of the episode.
Yeah, the first third of it, he's not in it. It's mostly the Paternoster gang. The only thing you get is the image in that guy's eye of the doctor screaming. My understanding is I believe they did make this like a half Dr. Light because they needed Matt Smith to be free to film other episodes. And so they found a way to just like keep him out of the story for a little while to free him up for a few days of shooting.
But also having the Paternoster gang, you go, oh, okay, cool.
Yeah. Especially because I think Mark Gatiss has written them the best. I think he did the best way of like writing them without making them feel funny, but not jokes.
The Paternoster gang is a quintessential like example of writing D&D characters in cinema.
God, yeah, that true.
Well, because it wasn't until I was like, oh, cool, we're getting to see like Jenny do her thing and she's picking locks, like she's going undercover. Mm-hmm. I went, oh, cool, she's the rogue of the party.
Yeah.
And then she tears off her dress and I went, oh, she's subclass rogue. She's a fighter or like a monk.
She's a ninja. She's a ninja who gonna punch her way through all these supermodels.
So then that did give me the follow up of what are the other classes that we see between Vastra and Strax.
Strax feels very much like, I almost called him Drax from Guardians of the Galaxy.
I mean,
but they're both very similar. They both have like barbarian vibes.
Mm hmm.
So we've got Strax, who is definitely a barbarian.
Mm-hmm. But he uses guns. He's not.
Well, I feel like it's that we're not talking about like what they fight with. We're talking about their personalities.
OK,
because I feel that Madame Vastra is definitely a wizard.
I was trying to think of other classes that are
because like, she's got a big house where she keeps all her cool stuff.
Well, because I halfway wanted to say druid just because she does have like an atrium.
Mm hmm.
And she's a lizard.
Yeah, the specifically for Strax, oh, when I say barbarian, there's that moment where he gets told to go cool off and just like, fine, I'll go play with my grenades.
And then Thomas.
I saw your face light up at the name Thomas, and I felt the sand slip through my fingers of what I thought had been your favorite moment in the episode.
You did not for a second think that Dickensian street urchin named Thomas wouldn't immediately rise to be
my
favorite thing in the whole episode.
In fairness, the thing that I had picked was the doctor squeaking around in pain.
That's fair.
Barely able to move more than an action figure of the Doctor would.
Okay, but Thomas.
But yeah, you're right.
You take a right and then a left, and if you've gone here, you've gone too far, so you have to go back a little bit. What is your name? Thomas. Thomas. Are you fucking with me? That's so funny.
In fact, you know what? That might be Cassie's favorite moment in the entire show so far.
Done. Podcast over. We did it.
Who is Cassie's doctor? Thomas.
Done. I am glad that they did bring him back, because I was like, oh, I fucking swear, this is like a one-off like gag. Because he does help Strax later on.
Yeah, he like points out the stuff that's happening on the roof. Oh, man.
But Jesus. Yes. Other favorite part. So you were wrong. I mean, there were like top three. The other was the fainting goat of a man. Well, just I really love a gag where he does nothing. He just stops and then falls. They went, we need to find a stunt person that can do like a death. What is it? Like the dead man's fall?
Yeah.
Where he's just,
yeah.
We need to find a stunt person who can do that.
Mm hmm. And we'll make him do it three times.
Because comedy comes in threes.
Yeah. Do it for Madame Vastra. He'll do it for Strax. He'll do it for the TARDIS. And it's good every time.
My God. By the third time I went, because it happened twice, and I went, this bitch is going to faint again.
And then they wait just long enough for you to forget about it.
Yep. And then you see him.
I saw you, like, he walked back into camera at the end of the episode, and I saw you, like, visibly light up because you knew what was about to happen.
Uh-huh. I was very, very vindicated.
Yeah, I have a real fondness for this episode. It's not, like, high art, but what it does, it does so well.
It's silly.
Yeah.
It's also something, too, where this was one of the first times watching an episode of Doctor Who I went, this doesn't necessarily have to be a Doctor Who episode.
Mm-hmm.
This you could transplant and put in any other universe. But the fact that we have these extra Whoisms,
mm-hmm,
in the Paddington gang.
The Paddington gang.
Pendergast.
The Paddington gang and his new friend Thomas Marmalade.
But because you have these specific Whoisms that you can plug in, and it just makes the episode go from very good to even better.
Yeah. Like, yes, you could do this kind of story in a lot of different places. It didn't even necessarily have to be set in like Victorian Yorkshire. Like, there's plenty of places a story like this could work, but the fact that they do set it that way then gives Matt Smith permission to do his doofy little Yorkshire accent. Hello, Nova. We're looking around. We wanted to live in Sweetville, we are. Fucking Dick Van Dyke sounding ass accent.
Since you touched on that, the jaunty little flashback.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have to do that.
I don't know. Speaking of the jaunty little flashback, this is really marveling. How did they do that to Clara's hair? Is that a wig?
So it's not unlike what they actually did for Lucille's ball.
My favorite party, Lucille's ball.
Lucille's ball. Lucille Ball's hair. So it's a method where you do finger curls, and they're just very tight little curls that you just like take all of the hair.
Okay.
Bring it all the way up. And then you have these like little teeny tiny tight curls that then you just pin in place. So you have what is effectively just like you've poodled your own hair, you know,
mm-hmm,
poodles like the dogs.
I didn't think you were using poodle as like,
well, because it's just a matter of finger curls, and then you
pin it all up the top.
You pin it all up at the top, and then you specifically then use the bonnet to like cover up where the hair is being pulled up, so that way then you just have all of your hair.
And I assume finger curls take a while.
Oh, yes.
Okay. So she had to plan this
for... Finger curls or pin curls. Now, there's a non-zero chance that they just went, oh, we're going to be filming for a couple days, so we're going to style a wig in this way and just keep it looking good. If it was a wig, it was a hell of a wig, because there was no visible laces. There was no visible nothing. Or like a half piece where it's just here, we're going to style the front, like the crown of her hair, but then everything else behind that is going to be synthetic. Okay. There's a couple things that they could have done, but either way.
I was just curious because her hair is so clearly normally straight.
It's also something to be said too that historically, a lot of times those types of styles, I'm specifically referring to the 50s, but it wouldn't have been impossible in other eras where you would go and have your hair specifically styled. Yes, it would take hours. But then from that point forward, that's when you would have like little hair nets and things to keep it in place. That's when you would see ladies with their hair tied up in scarves and preserving the style until they were going out and doing they were doing for the
day.
So yeah, something like that would take a while.
So I'm just picturing like Clara being like, "Oh, we're gonna go to London. Well, I need us to not go for like 12 hours."
Now here's the thing: is I imagine the TARDIS going, "Oh, we're going to London, Clara. Come here,
come here, sweetie.
Come here. We've bonded now. I'm gonna do your hair.
Come into my salon room.
Yes,
I built one just for you
with little robot hands, like in WALL-E. You're gonna look gorgeous." You remember those?
I do. Well, I'm picturing more like, you know, she knew that she had to plan this like 12 hours in advance. and then 12 hours later, they don't come out in London. They come out in Yorkshire. Can you imagine if she went through like the hours long process of getting her hair like that? And then that's when they walked out into the Russian submarine.
I'd be pissed.
I'm surprised they don't do that more often, where characters are just like dressed for the wrong era. Because the TARDIS just flew to the wrong place.
I also like that. I like the bringing back of the Doctor and his companion being dressed appropriately.
Yeah, I do miss the purple suit. But, you know, if he's got to wear a suit, at least he's got a nice little derby hat with this out. He's got a doofy little hat. The Doctor needs more doofy little hats.
Yep.
The Second Doctor understood this. And that's why Matt Smith wears a doofy little hat, because he likes the Second Doctor.
Yeah.
I really want to talk about Diana fucking Rigg, though. Diana Rigg is the woman playing the villain of the episode, Mrs. Gillyweed.
I hate her.
I
hate her so much. Say, Zach, speaking of narcissistic mothers.
So Diana Rigg is one of the most iconic women to be on film ever.
What else has so she
her
been
big
in?
Her biggest things are she was in On Our Majesty's Secret Service, the James Bond movie. She is the only Bond girl to ever marry James Bond.
Whoa!
Sure, it was the worst James Bond. It was George Lazenby, but that doesn't matter. The important thing is that Diana fucking Rigg was a badass bitch enough to lock down James Bond. She was also in Game of Thrones, I think, is her other really. I think more people know her from Game of Thrones than anything else, because she plays a woman who is in mastery of her political machinations from her entire appearance. Like her entire thing is playing chess with everyone else while they are playing checkers.
You just said a lot of like really intelligent words. I'm going to need you to say that again. she's talking to a child.
She's smart political lady in medieval time show.
Ah, thank you.
She's like marrying off her like gorgeous daughter to like a child king.
You said the word machinations, and then the only thing I can think
your
of.
Your brain was trying to spell the word machinations for 20 minutes. No,
brain went, the inner machinations of my mind are an enigma.
She was in the Avengers, not the Marvel Avengers. She was in there's a very popular British series called The Avengers. That's why in the UK, the movie had to be called Avengers Assemble because of copyright issues. We also saw her in Last Night in Soho, the Edgar Wright movie where the girl is like seeing the visions of the past. Diana Rigg is Anya Taylor-Joy's older version in that movie.
Yeah. Okay.
So. To the woman who rents out the apartment to that girl. Yeah, so that's her in that movie. Yeah, she's had a huge career. She's incredibly successful. She's a wonderfully talented actress. And they give her just a deliciously evil character, like a character that knows she is a bad person and enjoys every second of it. There was even a point where the Doctor's like, in the wrong hands, this stuff could poison everyone and kill everyone on Earth. And she's like, well, look at these hands. These are the wrong hands. I'm just like, okay, that's the way we're going now. This character understands This character understands that she is a bad person and she loves it, which are not, they're not interesting characters, but they're wonderful to watch.
Mm-hmm.
Like even like we reveal that she experimented on her daughter until she had gone blind.
I really liked Ada.
And also Ada is played by Diana Rigg's actual daughter.
No fucking wonder. Because right? I was like, their chemistry is so good.
They have acquired that chemistry over a very long career.
How awful Miss Gillyweed is being,
mm-hmm.
and just Ada's it was nothing in the performance, but the specificity of how she said, Mama. And I was like, oh, this is, she's either.
There's something very genuine here.
I was like, she's either one hell of an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not at all being like, it's discredited now. I'm sure she's very good,
mm-hmm.
but being able to be the daughter of somebody truly malicious and that vile,
yeah.
but still.
But have a genuine affection for her because she's your actual mother.
Yeah. Oh my God. She's so sweet.
And I really like the one.
It got to the point where in my head I went, I could have a daughter named Ada. Write that down in my baby name.
She's so mean. She's like, oh, my sweet child, you've always been so useful. And she's like, got a gun pointed to her head. I'm like, what the fuck is happening? This character is undergoing negative arc.
Oh, and she just calls the doctor my monster.
Yeah, that was another point where I was like, Cassie's really going to love the my monster element too. To this relationship, because it's never super clear if it's romantic or if it's just like
he's her only friend.
Yeah, she has such a low view of herself. She feels the only other friend she can have has to be like, equally monstrous.
It's something where it's like, because I'm sure she could have had like a pet,
mm-hmm.
a cat, dog, something like that. But also
she did. Yeah. The doctor.
But that's the thing, is it's also like it stands then that my monster, the doctor in that particular context, is serving the part of this being that needs her to survive.
Yeah.
In a way that she doesn't get to be nurturing in any other capacity.
Yeah.
She's taking care of herself.
Mm-hmm.
And now this other person that she is rescuing.
And one thing that I think the episode does really well is when we first hear the My Monster thing,
mm-hmm.
and we don't see the doctor, we just like hear the like sounds inside the room, or like a hand comes out. There's a part of it where we feel like, ooh, this is not good. Like this feels like she's keeping something or someone in there, and it's like a very possessive relationship. But as the episode goes on and we learn more about Ada, it really is just like a deep, like low self-esteem thing where she has been abused and used and manipulated into having such a low opinion of herself,
mm-hmm.
that the only friend she thinks she can have is a literal reject, a quote unquote monster that cannot take care of himself.
Is somebody
because
that
the preservation process has given him the joints of a Ken doll.
It's also occurring to me now in this moment that it was not only just a reject, but one of her mother's rejects.
Yeah, so.
You know, like Ada herself.
Yeah.
Love that.
What a really great episode. I think this is very well done. Talking about the doctor stuck in his like Crimson Horror.
Oh,
film.
I also loved that. I'm not going to let that slip.
Yeah. The detail that Matt Smith specifically adds that I don't know if it was in the script or not.
Is his manic eye acting? Yes.
I was going to say the fact that his jaw is stuck open.
Oh, yeah. I think that was just him trying to like not being silly, but like, let's see how far I can take this.
I do like that for some reason the cure for the Crimson Horror is to stuff yourself into a locker and cover yourself in green.
Yeah.
I think that's very fun. And then Clara is not one of the rejects. She actually manages to survive the process.
Well, not a jar so much as it was a cloche.
Yeah, I would still count it as a...
Well, yeah. I mean, you said jar. I'm just correcting you for once.
Fair enough. You get the point. You do get the point for them being stored in a jar. I like that when she goes through that same process to be decrimsoned, she's like a little loopy. very much like the vibe I was getting mostly was like Jasmine when she's pretending to have to go to the doctor.
Oh, hello, doctor.
How are you? Not that one. It's very much like, doctor. And she's like poking his nose. And she's got just this look in her eyes like everything is.
I do like that Jenny immediately is like,
she's supposed, a llama, she's supposed to be dead.
Yep. The entire time she's just going, but she's dead. Doctor, she's dead. No, you're going to need to.
The doctor's like, it's complicated. She's like, I'm going to need something to work with because otherwise you sound like an insane person. You're
going
to need to give me some information.
All of them just
all of them see Clara just, but what?
I was going to say they did my favorite, least favorite thing that you can possibly do.
What's
and
that?
Just wait, what?
But you and she, but she, it was with the death and the ice lady and the fall and the turn into pudding. Speaking of falling and not turning into pudding, is that just something, I guess, that doesn't happen in the Victorian era? Because Diana Rigg also fell off a scaffolding and landed on concrete, but didn't turn into pudding.
Yeah, I thought for a hot second I saw a pool of blood and I went, finally, nothing.
No, it was just
a scarf.
Yeah.
I went, oh, man.
God.
I guess their bones are denser back then? I don't.
And then I like that, you know, just speaking, we're doing train of thought points here. When she's down on the ground, she goes, forgive me, child. Forgive me.
Never.
That's my girl.
Oh, did you?
I do like that. And that's the last moment she gets is acceptance of her daughter.
Yep.
It's not an arc, but it is a twist right at the end. For that character where this person that has been nothing but cruel to her, the one time she finally like accepts her is when she is cruel back.
Yep.
Well, I shouldn't say the one time she's cruel back. She did beat her with her cane.
Yeah, she beats her with her cane. She doesn't push her off the scaffolding. But
no, she I believe Strax is firing at her and she falls.
Ada does nothing to assist. Granted, she can't see that her mother is falling.
Yeah, she does nothing to assist. In fact, she just tells another, she says never, and her mother immediately dies, and then she walks over to Mr. Sweet and bashes him to death.
Like, speaking of which, having somebody like Mrs. Gillyweed say, I found him in the river. You deranged woman!
The way this
put
is
it back!
The way this is a character you would love to have played.
I found him
in the river.
Me
holding up Monty. I found him at the bowling alley.
Yeah. I found him in the trash. As he's like, ah, ah, trying to get out.
And nothing has changed.
Nope.
I think it's very interesting that they have found a way to do Nazis before Nazis, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Just
like her whole thing was like you had to be physically attractive to even qualify to be put in the marrow of Sweetville.
A caveat of that, though, too, is that there were some of the men that were in her, like, quote unquote, supermodel army where I went, you're not like hot.
You got to remember my British standards, my British.
Well, because there was also a part of me that went, oh, maybe she has like a very strict like. There's certain requirements that you have to meet. Whether or not it's
you're auditioning for a cast member at Universal Studios.
Yes. Where you have to be these specific measurements.
Yeah.
I've
already made the suit. You have to fit in them.
Yeah.
You can't be part of my supermodel army if you can't fit in the jacket.
I will say that the human cloches that she has and like the way that everybody is staged was giving me oh my god, there's a great big beautiful tomorrow shining at the end of every day,
the Carousel of Progress.
Thank you. It was giving me Carousel of Progress energy.
I like the little detail that there's like a pumping air into the cloche so they can breathe.
Yeah,
I think that's really fun. Even if you don't find them attractive, there is a part of it where like it's not about them being truly like conventionally attractive. They just have to be attractive and fit according to Mrs. Gillyweed.
Yeah, not like, Aryan standards.
Yeah, she's the one who gets to decide who lives and who dies in this scene. And so there's this total element of power to it where she just gets to decide who is handsome or pretty enough to join her dollhouse. That's the thing is when you pose them and you put them in little cloches that keep them from moving and they're preserved, they look like they're dolls.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they ever resolve what happens to the rest of Sweetville.
Nope.
Do you think they're just there? Yep. Or do you think the doctor's like, all right, we got to stuff all these guys into lockers. Put all the hot.
Oh, shit. Yeah, you're going to have to I'm sure that's a job then that gets delegated to
Paternoster Gang.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make a little bit of sense.
Or Thomas, give him something to do.
Thomas, because he's the bombus. Mm-hmm. He'll cure what ails you, and he'll sell you a newspaper after.
Twas Pirelli's miracle elixir. I think that's why I love Toby so much.
Toby.
Also, something else that we just glossed over. I love me a giant glass bottle full of red liquid.
A giant glass jar of Kool-Aid.
Oh, my goodness.
When that jar grows up, it's going to burst through walls going, oh, yeah.
Oh, no. After it sees that.
After it sees the rocket that it's said to go into. I like how they don't address at all that there's a fucking rocket in the inventory.
Where did she get that? Where did she get that? How did she make it?
Did Mr. Sweet tell her how to make that? So here's the thing you're going to do, sweetie. We're going to put together an internal combustion engine. You don't know what that is yet.
I'm also still a little confused on their symbiotic relationship. I know that he's feeding off of her and he gives her nectar.
So, yes, he gives her her nectar. He gives her his nectar, which she seems to really enjoy.
Slurm.
Yeah, basically slurm. He gets to feed off of her blood. Here's the real question. How much of that stuff does he make at a time? Because he's like a little guy. Like, I know we joke that Daleks are little guys. He's also a little guy.
He's the size of like a kitten, like a newborn kitten.
Yeah, he's the size of a naked mole rat.
Yes.
And he, for some reason, has the ability to make vats and vats of this ooze.
I thought they said it was diluted.
I guess it is diluted. Like, because they needed to know how much they needed to, like...
But even still, the color is vibrant enough.
It's definitely not just, like... It's not mostly water. That don't look like Kool-Aid. That looks like paint. Yeah, it looks like paint. Paint or, like, red pudding.
Don't ruin pudding for me, Zach. You have said pudding now 3 different times. Do not fucking ruin pudding for me.
Yeah, just, that little guy...
Evil, horrible, I hate him.
He was really good.
I found him in the river.
Or do you think that he was by the river with just like jars and jars of his stuff trying to sell it?
He's been hoarding it.
waiting for the wrong hands to come by.
Mrs. Gillyweed, I have the wrong hands. What was she doing in the river?
Whatever she wanted.
Okay, but realistically, what was she doing in the river?
Going for a nice leisurely stroll.
Skinny dipping. Ugh, you would not want to swim in a Victorian river, though.
No, especially not downstream.
No.
This is our first episode where I think where Jenny really gets to shine.
Yes.
Because we've had, obviously, Madame Vastra got her, is obviously like the leader of the group. So I think she got her first episode, and Strax is not really going to be a character that's going to have like big dramatic moments, but he's always funny. Jenny's just kind of felt like the tag along, in for lack of a better term. And that's nothing against her. Mm-hmm. That's just what she's been written so far. So this is the first time they made a deliberate choice to let Jenny go off and do her own thing and establish her own character.
Well, because she's doing a task that only she can do.
Of these three, she is the only one who can go and be the pretty girl.
You know, she's the only one who can appear human.
Without wearing a veil.
Yeah.
I do.
Which
like
I also like that at any opportunity where if somebody's making Vastra a little bit peeved, she reveals what she is.
And I like that for some reason, no one can tell that she's bright green through a black veil.
See, that was my thing. I was like, I wonder if everybody in Victorian England just had really bad eyes. I mean, everybody has an astigmatism.
Or they just don't want to, like, question it. They don't want to, they're like, I'm not going to say, like, it would be rude to ask.
Somebody else who we have not touched up on whatsoever.
Okay.
I'm blanking out on what his role would be. Like, the Undertaker.
Oh, the doctor that, like, the...
Oh, that's no doctor.
I guess the, not Undertaker, the,
Mortician?
Yes, the mortician, thank you. The guy doing the autopsies on all these corpses.
It's the Crimson Aura, we call it.
I like to imagine that he only called it that the once in front of the doctor, and because the doctor went, oh, that's a great name, he was like, well, I'm going to say that to everybody now.
He was the one and only character in this episode where I went, they just plucked him out of an anime, didn't he?
He doesn't even seem all that. He seems like slightly shocked by her reptile face, but doesn't like. But he's not going to faint. He just is a little surprised by it. He just seems like one of those dudes.
He felt like the only human in a Muppets movie.
That's what Diana Rigg was in. Diana Rigg was also in The Great Muppet Caper.
Oh, cool.
That's what I was trying to remember. I was blanking on that earlier. So she did everything you would ever want to do. She was in James Bond. She was in Doctor Who. She was in The Muppets. Like, what a full, illustrious career she had. She was in Game of Thrones. She did everything.
Most importantly, the Muppets.
I do think that there is something interesting that it's saying about, like, this eugenics process that she's doing. Like, you would talk about how you said they're not conventionally attractive, but we so often think of, like, eugenics, quote unquote, as being in against, like, a particular race or a particular creed, particular, like, nationality, those sorts of things. This is the first one. One of the first things I've ever seen where it really is just like, I get to choose who lives and who dies. And then I put you through a really intense process to whittle you down even further. I think there's something very interesting to, like, analyzing it, like the reason why this sucks beyond just like the racism of it. Why it's like it's handing way too much power to one specific person who gets to decide these things.
Not even like one specific person, like. Somebody who in most cultures would be like an auntie.
Yeah.
Like just somebody that is older. Therefore, you like give your respect, whether they are part of your like nuclear family or not. And so having this old woman just go, I will keep you. I will keep you. I will not keep you.
Oh, and then we'll dip all of you in a vat of goo and whichever
and leave you outside.
And whichever one of you breathes through the entire process of being dipped in a vat of goo, you will get to be my dolls, my little dollies that I will keep in my little houses.
That's so fucked up.
Yeah, I like everything about this episode. This is one of my like sleeper hits. Like I always forget
hit
because this isn't an episode that shows up on like the greatest Doctor Who episodes of all time. Like people aren't going to mention it the same name as like Blink or Vincent the Doctor, those sorts of things. But every time I watch it, I'm like, this fucking slaps.
This feels like an episode that I could see myself returning to if I am in the mood to watch a. If I'm in the mood to watch Matt Smith be a silly asshole for a little bit.
Yeah, it's a great time. I certainly enjoyed it. I
do have a little bit of a qualm with how it ends.
Okay.
I suppose it would be it's like cold close.
Okay. And what
just what part that the kids that the kids that Clara's nannying for.
Oh, yes.
That close.
That they found pictures of her throughout history.
Because first of all, where the fuck were these when were these pictures taken? And by who?
I mean, that's a good question.
Because there's one of them on the sub. Like, was there somebody walking around with a camera that we missed?
I mean, there was a whole...
Was it the Martian holding a camera?
They did have to get a whole journey down the South Pole. So they had plenty of time for someone to want to take a picture with all of them.
True. Because, like, here's where I'm split on that because I don't like the kids immediately being like, ew, you're time traveling boyfriend. Yeah, you know all about it. But I do like that this is the first time where she sees a photo of herself and goes, that's not me.
Yeah, no, that's not. I wasn't in Victorian London. I was in Victorian Yorkshire. I think that was a very fun way of doing it. It also without spoiling too much, is the lead into the next episode, because the next episode, the doctor is now obligated to take the kids on an adventure.
Oh, geez. Oh, no.
I do like that the whole reason they even are trying to go to Victoria in London is sort of revealed that the doctor is trying to, like, get Clara to meet, to see other Clara, or, like, at least, like, snoop around the area, see if there's any, like, any magic that can happen if I put Clara back where Clara was. But instead, they miss. Yeah, but yeah, those kids will be important next episode, because next episode is the other episode written by Neil Gaiman. Which, on the one hand, is unfortunate that we have to talk about that again. But on the other hand, is his less good episode. So I'm curious.
I mean, the first one couldn't have been that great because I forgot what it was.
That was the you reference it often. It's the Doctor's wife. Where the TARDIS comes alive.
Yeah, that's really funny.
I think you might have even referenced it just last episode. I think it was just that's a detail we just like scrub away because we're bothered by him.
I just close my eyes.
We're moving from one color to another color because we're going from the Crimson Horror to Nightmare in Silver. And you'll find out why it's a Nightmare in Silver.
It's because of all the is it because of the kids?
Well, I guess you'll find out.
Do they age rapidly?
I guess you'll find out on the next episode of Who Is My Doctor?
Who is my doctor?
Who is indeed? Hey there, gang. Thanks for checking out another episode. Hope you enjoyed it. And I hope you're subscribed, because I've got some big stuff planned for Cassie to see. So after we finish the season, we're going to be completing her first looks at the classic Doctors with the first Doctor story, The Daleks, and the Eighth Doctor TV movie. We're also going to be looking at the first Peter Cushing movie, all of the classic multi-Doctor stories, so that's the Three, the Five, and the Two Doctors. We're doing Remembrance of the Daleks, the baffling Dimensions and Time special, and of course, The Night of the Doctor. Who knows? Maybe in the time it takes us to get through all this classic stuff, the modern era of the show will find a new streaming home. Wouldn't that be nice? Anyway, if that sounds fun to you, make sure you're subscribed so you don't miss an episode. You can get all those episodes a week early by supporting us over on Patreon at patreon.com/whoismydoctor for as little as $1 a month. Huge thanks to our Big Daddy Dalek patrons, Andrew Blewett, David Gansel, and Travis Aiken. And we'll see you next Tuesday, because your Tuesdays are now Whose Days.